Thanks a lot for this and inviting me here, Alex and Adrian. It was a great pleasure this week already. I was on holidays last week, but had at least as much fun that week, I must say. So what I will be talking about is work that we do in Leiden in the Netherlands, and mainly Kirsten is working on this, but we have a team to make this possible. What I will present you, and that is Mio, Petter, and Henk in the past. This wouldn't have started without Harry and his team, because a couple of years ago we started talking about these things, so with QSoft, and then there was a quantum software consortium starting, and this is now one of the many results that came out of that. We also work together with UCSB, where samples have been made in the past with Dirk Baumeister, who has also part-time affiliation in Leiden. I want to give you a bit an experimentalist view on quantum position verification, in particular talking about single photon sources, so not two as before, two photon interference, and then how we want to do a demo in QPV. So first, this is large part of the Netherlands, so Amsterdam, CWI here, and Leiden is here, here's the beach. And there's a straight line. There are no mountains in between or so. And so Harry, this is one of the less demanding pictures of him, but he was pretty demanding that he wanna do some free space QPD because it's so flat, you might think. So there's a website where you can actually check this. We start, here's a CWI. This is a data center next to it. And this is a direction. So you can really check if something in the line of sight. And this looks quite good. There's even a gap at the south axis of Amsterdam by chance. I really didn't fake it here. And but this I also didn't fake. We would get into trouble at Schiphol Airport, Amsterdam Airport, with a beacon beamer, I think. Anyway, we would end up in Leiden. This is our building. This is a flying saucer, a lecture hall next to that. And this is a new building, actually, that was at that time being built still. And so this might be possible. But as we've heard already, and I will come briefly, probably come back later, free space, ground level, very hard. And we don't have drones. We cannot do that. This is too complex for us. And so we want to do a demo with fibers, optical fibers, and keep it simple in the lab to explore the technical challenges and also to apply our single photons, actually. So about what do experimentalists care? Then we were looking at some QPV protocols, and I must say this list is actually has evolved a lot, because at that time, as we were starting the discussion, there was basically the BB84 protocol, and quite recently the LIM protocol, which uses the Bell measurement at a central location. So we have the same structure is all of the experiments here, that the verifier one sends quantum information most likely, and possibly classical information, verifier two, the same to a central prover, and there might be attackers oriented around it, and then the prover task result is communicated again to the two verifiers. And now we were looking at these protocols, and I added here two columns, loss tolerance and slow quantum information. And this is what we care about. I will come back to that also later. And of course, the first protocol is not loss tolerant and also doesn't tolerate for slow quantum information, but still I'm not sure if this problem has been solved in any protocols. Therefore, we are very happy that Judge Lim came up with this protocol that is loss tolerant, because without loss tolerance, we cannot do this experiment basically with full loss tolerance. And then we were talking to René, Harry, Florian, and Philip in Amsterdam, and they then came up with another protocol that is even a little bit better than the LIM protocol, which is called the SWAP protocol. And so this protocol is what we try to realize.
Can you explain loss tolerant?
Yes. No, partially only, I'm sure, because I'm not a theorist. But so it means that we can lose 99.99%. Hugely loss tolerant. So we had endless discussions about this, but 50%, 10%, 1% transmission tolerance is not enough, usually, for optical experiments. And what do we need for this? We need two single BB84 qubits, but a lot, so high rate. And we need to do the swap test, which means we need to have really equal photons if you want to have them equal. Encode them, of course, the quantum information in some degree of freedom, and to tune this swap test. Let me go back to quantum states briefly, because I want to now also fill these quantum states with some essence, some physical essence, as I would call it. Very briefly, we have the computational basis in vector notation, of course, 1001. The basis, and from this we can then also build the superposition Hadamard basis, and the last one, mutually unbiased basis to this, is of course the imaginary basis plus minus I, probably called by mathematicians. And as a fun fact, because I'm also working in high-dimensional quantum information already for six-dimensional qubits, we don't know how many mutually unbiased bases we have. So for an experimentalist, this is an exciting fact that mathematicians don't know everything all the time. Okay, and the nice thing now is that in physics we can encode these qubits into any degree of freedom of a particle. And in particular, useful is polarization, as we said several times, because then actually this state vector, if you have the two amplitudes of a qubit superposition, Ex plus Ey, which is somewhere up here, it corresponds directly to the electric field or Jones vector of light. And therefore, also the diagonal, anti-diagonal polarization can simply be visualized as an electric field that's oscillating along a certain direction. That's really how it is. We have the quantum field that is oscillating in a certain direction. And the third one is very funny because it spirals around like circular polarization. But what carries this quantum information? Let me show you a brief experiment that convinces most people that single photons exist. We have these multi-pixel single photon detectors nowadays. Expensive iPads have it too, for LiDAR, for to range, to sense your face that you're not a picture for the face ID. And you do this, you shine my laser pointer over many pixels, and with this we can count photons. It's very hard to have photon number resolving detectors, therefore this is a poor man's photon number resolving detector, and it agrees perfectly what we get for certain photon numbers, probability here, to what you would expect, and which is of course the Poisson distribution of coherent states, because coherent states from the quantum harmonic oscillator known is an infinite quantum superposition of photon number states, these Fock states, n here. So this is actually very complicated compared to a single photon. So can we make a single photon from laser? Yeah.
Well, you said it's convincing for people to say there are single photons.
Yeah.
But I mean, they have to believe that they're single photon detectors, right?
Yeah, but if, good point. But if we now tune down the intensity of my laser pointer, attenuate, and we still detect from time to time, in agreement to the attenuation, a single click and then another single click, it's statistically pretty convincing, huh?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was just like you have to believe that there are these detectors that are single photon detector.
Yep, but I got nearly everybody probably except you convinced of it. If you have this rain droplet,
they're just
if you have this rain droplet, the rain picture, yeah, we have heavy rain. It's a noise is constant, and then little droplets, a fewer, and the same is with these detectors. It's exactly the same.
You don't believe in unicorns, but I have a single unicorn detector, and it goes off, so there must be
I agree. I find a single photon detector as exciting as a unicorn. But
I, of course, believe in single photons, so I don't need these tests. But it is true that there's a semi-classical theory that would explain those results. where you have a quantum mechanical detector and a classical light field, and you don't need to have photons to explain these results, but it's fine.
Yeah.
I believe in single photons, and the other experiments you're going to show would prove you have single photons, I think.
I'm not sure. I mean, if we use the semi-classical picture, I mean, we can measure single photon entanglement in Bell tests, so in the quadrature entanglement.
Because once you have your single photon source on this, you'll see that you can't get a G2 that's higher than, you'll get a G2 that's less than 1.
Yeah, I find too. No.
So then you can
yeah.
Anyway,
the unsplittability of single photons, this is.
It's a technical. Most people would be convinced by this.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. Most people. So. The only thing we can do in optics basically is interfering single photons. This is a beam splitter here, the splitting interface. We send in here a coherent state from there. And now if you do this and calculate that, we figure unfortunately out that coherent states are not orthogonal. So we can never achieve single photons. So this is a photon number statistic for different coherent states. And we just cannot make it a single probability density function with a single delta function like peak among one photon number. This is just the completeness of this, that we have two quantizations in physics. First quantization is in a way that we attribute quantum wave functions to objects that people before have not considered to be quantum. Of course, in hindsight now, 100 years later, that is, it's clear, everything is a quantum field. Now, the second quantization is to put excitations, single photons, into this, for instance, electric field modes of wave packets, quantum fields. And because we'll come back to that briefly, there are ladder operators which raise the number of excitations or lower it. And we can count the photons with a number operator. And just a warning, because we're dealing here now with single photons and not only with quantum states. These were quantum states cats. But now we have a different space. We have Fock space. And so we better write it as a certain number of photons in a certain state. And that is really different. And just as a fun fact, if you now have one photon right circular polarization, one photon horizontal polarization, the overlap is 1/2. It's a mutually unbiased, it's two states from two mutually unbiased bases, always 1/2 for qubits. Now, two photons right circular polarized, overlap is 2H photons, polarized, what's the result? So we have two photons here, and we make the sandwich between them, which means for orthogonal states it would be zero. But they are not orthogonal, they're mutually unbiased, so we get 1/2. Okay, it's not simple math actually. We have to use operators to calculate it. And then we get out 1/4. And if you now make this number go to infinity, then this will be zero. So in Fock space, really strange, many photons in one state times many photons in the other state, even for non-orthogonal quantum states, you get orthogonality. Has been, of course, worked out a very long time ago, not by me. But fun fact, Fock space. How do we make such a single photon? I always say that for visible single photons, the energy of a single photon is large. It's much larger than the Boltzmann constant times the temperature, which is the black body radiation, for instance, of me. That is very low compared to the energy of a single visible photon. So it must be easy to make single photons. Yeah, it's not. But so we have heard already about down conversion. With this, we can herald single photons, for instance, by detecting in one arm these photons with a good single photon detector, and then we know that in the other arm will be a single photon. Atomic decay, that's a nonlinearity. We'll, of course, come back to this. And there are really beautiful other systems, so carbon nanotubes you can use. You can use even tunneling through a vacuum gap of electrons. So if they lose energy, they produce single photons. And this paradigm of using a single electron, which is not so hard anymore to make, nearly at room temperature to make single electron transistors, if it then generate every electron a single photon, then we have a single photon source. I worked during my PhD on these things. It didn't improve much since then. It's It's also damn hard. Everything's damn hard. Okay, what we do is the following. Again, we have a two-level system. Yeah, two transitions in an atom or so. We use a normal laser, which wavy curve, to excite it. And then if it's excited, it can fall down and relax again in energy, this energy axis. And then we get a single photon out. This is a single photon, but the laser is still there, so our task is to block this laser. And for, as Paul mentioned, there were in SPDC, we have a 10 to the minus 10 chance to produce a photon pair. Here it's actually much higher if you do everything right, but still we struggle to remove the pump laser. And also in my first SPDC experiments, it's all about getting rid of the pump laser, what I learned. What can we do? We use some degree of freedom of light. We can use wavelength filtering, different colors as problems also. We can use temporal filtering. It doesn't really work, as I will show on the next slide probably. And we can use a direction. So some systems emit preferably in a certain direction. If you excite from the side, then this might work. Polarization filtering. That's the most simple one that we will also use in our experiments. So just how does it look temporally, this single photon production? We have, for instance, a very narrow excitation pulse, and this here is the probability that a photon that is still excited, the atom, so it shows an exponential decay with time. And so we could, for instance, make the pulse relatively short, and then we observe a certain time emission. Now you might ask, this gives huge uncertainties in the arrival time of photons, but if everything's nice, it's what we call it's lifetime limited. It turns out, if you solve simple differential equations here, that you get wave packets which have many, many more oscillations than what I show here, but I cannot plot it. So we have something which has a start, slowly the chance to get a photon increases, and then it goes down again. And this we can do in time. This is in frequency, Fourier transformed simply. And it turns out if you multiply these two Heisenberg uncertainty type quantities, then you end up at 0.444 Gaussian envelopes. And I want to briefly present now a semiconductor quantum dot in the optical microcavity, which is currently one of the most ideal systems, I think. And so it's like an atom, but it doesn't fall down. An atom has to be in a trap in ultra-high vacuum and whatever around that. And these quantum dots are in gallium arsenide. It's a semiconductor. And the amazing thing is we can grow this single crystal, so every atom nicely fits on the previous one, and introduce different materials even. And in this case, a little bit more indium, and here's a beautiful electron micrograph where the color gives the amount of indium, and this leads to the fact that the band gap, what the energy of electrons is lowered where there's more indium, so you get a potential well. This is now on the conduction band here. There's another valence band for the absent electrons holes, but this we don't need to discuss. And so electrons will fall into that, and then we can make somehow optical transitions here. And this is because in these trap states, we have orbitals like the hydrogen atom. These are calculations based on this, and they match very nicely what you have in hydrogen. And now we want to get out the photons efficiently out of our system. So we use two lenses, for instance. This is here a sketch of the quantum dot. Put a lens before, a lens behind, we focus laser light on it. We now want to make efficient interaction with light. There's a small problem because it turns out that the absorption cross-section of our quantum dot is roughly lambda squared. Lambda is the wavelength of the transition, but also our optical beam diameter is roughly, or the area is roughly lambda squared. So we will never ever make an efficient interaction because it needs to, of course, to be much larger than the beam to make an efficient interaction. Therefore, we put mirrors around it. And if you do this right, then the number of bounces enhances this, the size of our quantum dot effectively, and we can get into co-orbital relativity regimes, which is a figure of merit for this, which is pretty high. This is not done in a day or so. So this is our structure that we have developed in decades, one should say. And it consists, this now cross-section through it, it consists of a thin film mirror, as we call it, these alternating colors here at the bottom, then some electronic gates are there. In the middle is a quantum dot layer here, and on top is another mirror, and in order to confine the light vertically. And then we also need to confine the light. This should indicate the light mode here. Horizontally, we make holes. And then this shows a picture of such a beautiful, optical picture of such a beautiful device. These are the holes here that are sketched here. And then we oxidize a layer in it. And the little thing here in the middle is actually where the optical cavity is. So this sounds already everything technologically quite hard. It is also. It requires a long time of development. But if you once have it, then you can do the following experiment. I'm getting to the end with technology.
I've not seen this particular geometry before. What's the role of the trenches, the holes?
Yeah, to make we use hot water vapor oxidation of an aluminum arsenide layer, which becomes alumina, or it's not sapphire, but nearly. And this enters it. So we etch down these holes exactly such that we reach the aluminum arsenide layer, which is the oxide aperture, is it called? And then we do it. This is from John Bowers at UCSB for vertical cavity surface emitting lasers, developed method, and it's beautiful.
Oh,
it's unfortunately 400 degree water vapor is super aggressive. You don't want to have this in your clean room. So that is that's small complication. Then we can do this most beautiful experiment. After this, I could stop in a way. It is, we scan now a laser at around 900 nanometers or more or less, visible still a little bit near infrared, as very small wave frequency range, because so the carrier frequency is around 300 terahertz, so 5 orders of magnitude higher than gigahertz. And this we scan over such a cavity that we have. The frequency, and then we record in transmission and reflection the photons. And then we have this, that on resonance with an optical cavity, that here's some resonance condition, we get here transmission, despite the mirrors are so good that usually there's absolutely no transmission. But it's like quantum tunneling, and we send light in, and then there's a field built up in the cavity, and then we get transmission again through our cavity. It's just a fact now. Reflection, we have a dip. Now we introduce, we can tune this, our little quantum dot into this cavity, and then we see this. Where there was high transmission, we see no transmission anymore, and where there was low reflection, we see now nearly restoration of the full reflection that we had before. So which was only due to the little quantum dot in our cavity. Because it induces a phase shift. It's not so hard to calculate this. But what does it mean?
So what's the difference between the blue data and the green data?
Scan up, scan down. We were proud that this is not no hysteresis or so on this, but it's a very good point. I haven't seen it in ages. What are these photons? These must be single photons. Yeah, they were absent here. Every click is a photon, basically. And they are now back here. That means these must be true single photons. This is a true single photon. This two-level system has really just two states, excited, not excited. And they that means can only be excited once. And therefore, these are true single photons. So such an effort one has to make true single photons. And so we can even, just to show now a little bit more pictures, miniaturize this even more. So this is an atom optics lab. I just show this out of jealousy because they actually make even better single photon sources, but it's many square meter optical things on an optical table.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Can you go back?
Yeah.
One second? If you had two quantum dots in your...
Yeah.
What would happen to that right-hand picture?
I would actually guess it depends on the coupling. If how well everything is coupled to light. If it's coupled moderately, we are in a so-called bad cavity regime, and then it wouldn't change so much, actually, I think. However, the light that comes out, the second order correlation function would be dramatically changed.
Right, but this would look more or less the same. So this picture itself doesn't necessarily say that we have single photons, right?
Unfortunately, I cannot do this. I would love to do this experiment. It's to have several quantum emitters strongly coupled to the same light mode. That is, we are only getting there slowly, I think. And
okay.
I don't know. I mean, what is true is if you send in exactly two photons at the same time, this one of the photons does not feel anymore the quantum dot because the quantum dot is excited in this moment. So it is really a single photon nonlinearity. This is what in quantum information processing you would love to have to make a CNOT gate. Unfortunately, this measurement is relatively easy in emission. However, to make a CNOT gate, we need to make every photon interact with it with 90-something percent efficiency. And this, we are still not there. We're still not there, unfortunately. So therefore, we better make single photons. That has the community realized. It's easier, and then do photonic quantum computation in future.
Also. But there could be two. I mean, there could be two photons, right? I mean, it's not foolproof single photon. I mean, I think that was...
No.
Question, right?
No.
It's not from this, but it will be from the next measurement that he can show.
You were asking if we have two quantum dots inside.
Yeah.
Well, then this is the Tavis-Cummings regime where one gets, and it's quite complex. But no, these are... if we don't have the issue of re-excitation, that the first photon is emitted very quickly by chance, it's just probabilistically, like Schrödinger's cat, dead or alive, and these things. And that the second photon, then the quantum dot is excited again by the laser pulse, and then we have bad luck. But otherwise, these have a purity, so 1 minus the chance you have two photons, of 0.0001 nowadays. We are really getting into the regime that this is usable for photonic quantum computation. I mean, we can buy a six photon photonic.
There's the probability that there would be two.
Yeah, so very small. We are at a few percent, I must say, but we are still proud of it. Good. I briefly wanted to mention we can miniaturize it in principle even more. This is also just to show our latest setup. We built a vertical setup on an optical table, and this is everything. Just basically a fiber coming from top. Here's a beam splitter to separate the excitation detection path. This is our coffee machine like a cryostat. We work at 4 Kelvin, but we just press a button. It cools down basically nowadays. And then we detect the beam splitter here, reflects light here for detection. This will then be our single photons after we eliminated the laser using cross-polarization. And we have even made it smaller. This is now 2 centimeter size, a copper carrier, because, so this device, I forgot to mention, but this is absolutely small, 50 micrometer in diameter or so, and we can glue fibers to it, at least in principle. There are now some companies trying to commercialize these methods, and but we were the first to make this quite efficient, actually. Some only a few years ago. This is all quite recent. Good. Now coming back to what Paul mentioned, what cannot be done with any classical theory is this experiment that we send our stream of single photons on a beam splitter. They can be either transmitted or reflected, but actually, directly after the beam splitter, each photon is in a quantum superposition of being transmitted and reflected. However, the detector, this nature simply does it apparently, absorbs either a single photon or no photon. Now that means either this detector clicks or that clicks, this clicks. I just thought I have a coincidence, but I don't.
Detector
dark arts. Yeah, that is a potential problem. And so what we then plot. I'm not sure if you've seen one of these before in these days. It's a so-called second-order correlation function, called second order because a photon corresponds to intensity, to energies, and not fields, and which is a field squared. And this is why it's called second order. So, but it's just the number of photons detected here at time t times the number of photons detected at time t in the other detector, but plus a time delay, and then normalized somehow in the here. And then if you plot this, then we see such a thing for a continuous stream, random stream of single photons. This means here at zero time delay, we never detect in both detectors a single photon. That is all it means. But we have a problem to measure this accurately because our detectors are imperfect. We use relatively cheap ones, not superconducting cooled-down detectors. And therefore, this actually measures more detector than single photons. And if we therefore use a pulsed laser that we only offer at the same time as Paul had, 12.5 nanoseconds, everybody has that, the same lasers, then we can only detect two photons now, not at zero time delay, but in multiples of these 12.5 nanoseconds. And then the detector response doesn't play a role anymore. And we can calculate accurately what actually our quality of the single photons is. So just to wrap this up, this is what we call single photon light or anti-bunched light. So for each time bin, for instance, has a single photon. And the amazing thing is of single photon light, under loss, it's still single photons. We always have loss, so this makes us happy. But some of these disappear. And for completeness, so the laser light, what I have here, this is actually random. And there is candle light, what we have, we call them bunched light. There is more often several photons together than even in laser light. Turns out a candle makes this type of light. Good. Nowadays, we can make the single photon sources in many dimensions pretty well. But we want to make a swap test. That means we need two of these single photons, send them on a beam splitter, and we need to make quantum interference. I would like briefly now to mention this. But before this, again, motivate why we do the swap test very briefly. And this is coming back now to free space on ground level. Horizontal quantum communication, we have turbulences. The record, I think, please correct me, is 30 kilometers for non-zero key rate generation or horizontally in somewhere in China, I think, done. Probably with not so good air quality, I don't know. But this is really the record. After this, you have tremendous problems detecting any photons. And this shows a little bit how a snapshot would look like of a coherent photon field after turbulence, as we investigated that in the past. And it diffracts out. It's called also scintillation. It flickers the light. Astronomers have for this adaptive optics to compensate for, but astronomers look upstairs. And that's a big difference. Looking upstairs, our atmosphere is super thin. It's 10 kilometers only.
So Michael, years ago now, the Design Engineering Group did experiments between mountains in
Canary Island.
He cheated. I have a slide. He cheated.
He cheated?
Because 2.5 kilometer altitude, there is nearly no turbulences anymore. The air is super quiet at 2.5 kilometers altitude. It's ingenious to do this experiment up there.
So who did you quote for the 30 kilometer one?
I can look it up. I don't know. Yeah.
Because I know, I mean, John McCann's group also did something, but they also went, they also had mountains and they had like a big lake underneath.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So made it easier.
Yeah, but it's really, so Urban QKD, it's an optics express from some group, probably somewhere in Asia, I think. But it's, so we, for instance, calculated Delft University, 25, 30 kilometers away. We want to project the Leiden University logo on their building. No way, no way. I mean, it's really, it's just too turbulent, the atmosphere. I find it really surprising that this is not possible. This is also why, of course, to finalize the picture from Jamal Pan, this works. Yeah, twice 20 kilometers is actually not that much. And actually, the curvature of the Earth really limits it for usual buildings. So for 50 kilometers, and we heard that, I think, before. Just there's a beautiful Wikipedia page on, with the equations. They're not that simple. This is Zeilinger. He does it 134 kilometers teleportation, even La Palma, Tenerife, and but 2.4 kilometer altitude. No, that is the trick that he's been using. And so, therefore, we have fibers, but we still have loss. I'm sorry to tell you something about fibers. A fiber is an amazing thing, an optical fiber. Yeah? It is. So this is now from the side. Yeah? The diameter of such a fiber is 125 micrometer, tenths of a millimeter. It is amorphous silica, yeah? So amorphous quartz and sand, basically. And now the optical light is guided in 5 to 10 micrometer diameter thing. It looks a little bit like a Gaussian again. And you might ask, why does it need 125 micrometer thick cables? Would be much cheaper if you can make them thinner. But this, it's a Gaussian function. Yeah? It's really amazing with a width of 5 micrometer. And even the tails of this function here, here you have absorption, yeah, because it's lost if you're at the outside. But if you make it so thick, you can send it through 300 kilometer light and you get non-zero light out. And this is 300 kilometer of a block of glass. And you can imagine probably if you've seen it already, this thickness of glass is absolutely dark. Yeah? So what people develop for optical fibers to make it transparent, this is completely amazing. Yeah? This is, it's super amorphous material, no crystallites and these things. It took also decades to get there that it looks like this. But nevertheless, forget everything here. It is exponential absorption. And so for instance, for the one of the best fibers available, we have after 5 kilometer, 80% transmission, 50 kilometer, 15%, 100 kilometer, 3%, and then it gets 10 to the minus something.
So the thing is, it's this 125 micrometers thick, because if it was too thin, the light wouldn't fit or something?
No, this because then the core is always of this size. But these, if you calculate the Gaussian function, I should have done it, but I don't have here. And this will be a 10 to the minus whatever, probably 10 or so, of the maximum value here, the field. But still, it leads to scattering out of light out of the core.
You mean, yeah.
And so you
make it even thicker, it's even better.
And no, this is apparently where the balance of... there's other loss mechanisms, which is shown here, depending on wavelengths, Rayleigh scattering, and other excitations in the fiber, and there's a balance, then it doesn't make any sense anymore at a certain point.
I don't think much of the leakage is coming at the edges. It's coming from Rayleigh scattering.
Exactly.
I think you could make it 20 microns, and you still wouldn't have much different loss. It's just that it'd be too fragile. It would break all the
time. That is another reason, And so we have Rayleigh scattering and here infrared absorption at different wavelengths, and this is so by molecular vibrations in these systems. Good. So we have loss and we need to fight it, and therefore we use a loss tolerant protocol, and usually in QPV protocols the attackers with two photons can measure these photons in a certain basis, for instance. And then later on, they get figure out if they measured in the correct basis, and if they measured in the wrong basis, they can later on say, the photon was lost. That's as we had many times here, the problem with loss tolerance of many protocols. But in this protocol, where we use this quantum interference of two photons, this is not the case because there is no basis in which the attackers can measure. Everything is basically wrong, at least as far as I understand. Okay, so the protocol looks like this, and is here, this is now published. Also, it is one BB84 polarization photons come from here, one from here. We have a non-polarizing beam splitter where this effect, what I explained before, is happening. And then we have here another beam splitter with an 1, 2, 3, 4 detectors. Okay, and what can happen? What can happen in this is so if not two detectors click, then we call it inconclusive result. If the left two click or the right two click, then this photon bunching effect, actually, now I skipped over this, but so let me, I'm sorry for this. I skipped over this slide apparently. So this SWOT test means that after a, if you send in two photons and if they are equal, they will exit the beam splitter exactly in one direction together. Shall I briefly go over this, the SWOT test, how it works in physics? It's okay, I think. And I mean, this is, we had it several times, we can discuss it later, otherwise. Let's swap that, exactly, yeah. So this is the so-called Hongo-Mandel quantum interference effect. It's next to measuring G2, the Heimbach-Brown twist experiment, which we had before, smaller than one. This is one quantum effect, and this is the other genuine quantum effect in quantum optics. So if this happens, at the second beam splitter, therefore, there's a probability that the two photons which went along this path have will be detected by two detectors. And that's a nice extension of this protocol, that by detecting two here, we know that the photons have been, with a certain probability, have been equal. And on the other hand, if these, if different detectors click. So L1, for instance, and right one, or other combinations of this, then we know that the photons have not been equal. Because if equal photons always go to the same side. And this is, therefore, it's very nice for evaluating experimental data. Ah, sorry. No, I come to this. Let us briefly go over, to this. So this is, why is this happening, this effect? It's quite easy to see, but actually an example where it really shows you need to use operators. The calculation is pretty much wrong if you do it with cats. And the reason is because we need to have two photons in one of these directions. Now this is again a beam splitter. One is for input port where a photon can come. This will be, after this, in a quantum superposition between here and there. It's normalized, so 1 divided by square root 2. And we do this in quantum optics by writing an operator replacement rule. So a creation operator for photon in port 1 is translated to 1 divided by square root 2, creating one photon in mode 3 plus one in mode 4. And there's an I, which is super important, which is that the reflected photon versus the transmitted photon picks up a phase shift. And this phase shift is often not relevant because you know the phase of this light beam, what I have here, if I go only a quarter of a micrometer further, I make a phase shift of pi. But here, this is an essential phase shift if you make the math, it's quite clear. So we can do the same for a photon in mode 2. We have 4 plus AI3, so the reflected one this way and this, and then we can evaluate it for two photons at the same time. And now it's important to keep track of which modes, and since one, and I called them 1 and 2, probably not the most intelligent choice, but has happened here. Therefore, I call the modes written here, and this is a number of photons. One photon mode 1, one photon mode 2. We generate this by acting on vacuum with one creation operator in mode 1 and one in mode 2. And then we just do the replacement again. So this was this, and now we have 1 divided by 2 because square root of 2 times square root of 2 is 2. And acting on this. We just write it down, and voila, we see if this term here disappears, these terms disappear, so A4, A3 plus A3, A4, and since they act on different modes, they commute these operators, they disappear. That means the result is two photons in mode 3, 0 in mode 4, plus 0 photons in mode 3 plus 2 in mode 4. This is this crazy Hong-U-Mandel effect in quantum optics. And why is it now a swap test? Let's forget the data here probably in the experiment. We color one of them. Yeah? The photon here is now different in some degree of freedom. I made it here purple. Yeah? So all A's that are connected from this photon are now purple. Purple, 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 purple. And then you see this here. And this is not, since this A3 is purple and that is not purple, they don't cancel anymore. You get also one photon there, one photon there, and this is what's going on. And now we can measure this experimentally, and basically it's a difference between here having nearly no peak in such an experiment versus having here a big peak. And that is the test that we need to do. And this also concludes then, I just want to give an overview of single photon sources, state of the art nowadays. We have this indistinguishability, which determines how equal the photons are in its color, in its arrival time, in its polarization. We have otherwise under control. And that is a very important figure for quantum information tasks. We had already the brightness, chance to have a photon, if you want to have a photon. We had the purity, which is this Hambury-Brown twist. Second order correlation function, which was a dip going to zero. And actually another one very important is how many photons can we get per second until our system dies. And there we are at a gigahertz nowadays, or 10 gigahertz even. And this is such a plot where here the brightness is in a logarithmic scale. We should probably change that because we really need to be at one here. And this is the indistinguishability. And this is now quite some old plot where SPDC, down conversion, is extremely good in the indistinguishability, but if you crank up the brightness, we get two pairs, three pairs, and so on. And that's, it's hard to beat, but it took the quantum dot world decades to get to these values of achievable by indistinguishability of SPDC, and nowadays it's somewhere here or so. We are a little bit worse than some others. But we have to get this to this point. Then people get really excited about that stuff. What can we now do with this? And still have a little bit energy to absorb. I want to come back to one delay loop, also of Paul, because we are talking about a quantum memory. And we did recently a nice experiment, just one slide of this, to show in a slightly different configuration what we can do with a delay, optical delay. So what we have here in the experiment is just single photons come from the bottom. And this is the path of light, the black line. This is a beam splitter. So either here a single photon can be transmitted or reflected. And then we have here mirrors and direct it around and send it into the other input port. So what happens after the first photon is here? It will be in a quantum superposition of being inside and outside the loop. So then we do it such that if the next photon comes, the first photon or the part of the photon that is inside the loop arrives simultaneously at the beam splitter. And then this Hong-U-Mandel effect will be happening. But not with a normal single photon, but with a single photon in quantum superposition. This indicates a quantum superposition. And that means there is some strange effect happening, which in fact actually entangles all photons at different times. So this is really why such a loop is indeed a bona fide quantum memory. I mean, we can with this entangle multiple photons, and in fact, this is one of the ways to make linear cluster states. So many photon entanglement, unfortunately, is not fully deterministic. So this is something which is which doesn't scale to 100 photons. But reaching 7-8 photons, colleagues of us are doing currently. We reached 3 or 4. After this, let's go to our QPV demo. What we want to do, we want that verifier 1 and verifier 2 have a single photon source, a polarization modulator to create BB84 qubits, send them over long fibers because we don't have the free space capability to the prover. And there, all this, what I've shown before, is implemented in fiber. So with a fiber type beam splitter, a directional coupler is it also called. And then we have these other beam splitters. It's just a coupler from 1 into 2 and another one, and then 4 single photon avalanche photodiodes. And then we use also FPGA logic to make a very quick evaluation of the this conclusive, inconclusive, or what's the third thing?
Equal or different.
Equal or different things, what we do. And then the information is sent back in future with radio frequency, with speed of light, to the verifiers. And but now we just use, of course, BMC cables and normal evaluation, because we're not yet there. How do we make 2 single photon sources? I was talking so long about it. Yeah, please.
So on the last slide, how fast can you do the computation in the inside?
We don't know yet fully, but it should be. We use the what's it called on the FPGA? You have these gates, really, and this is nearly instantaneous. So what we also don't know is the delay in our single photon detectors will be a few nanoseconds. We use 200 meter fiber, which is a microsecond.
So how does that compare to the time it takes to travel down here, like from the verifier to the prover?
Exactly, and this is a verifier prover is 200 meter, 1 microsecond roughly.
Yeah.
And we have a couple of nanoseconds of time. And I skipped over this, but this our paradigm is a little bit that we say that this just increases a certain unsafe radius around the prover. Yeah? And so we like this expression safe space. There needs to be a safe space. There will always be delays. And Kirsten has worked out also that, it's the same thing if you have slow quantum information. You just need to make a fence bigger.
Yeah. Okay.
For a demo.
What kind of detectors do you have?
The normal Perkin-Elmer or Excelitas spats.
I'm not positive, but I think, because we've used these also, I think the latency will be something like 10 or 15 nanoseconds.
Nanoseconds, huh? Yeah. Have you measured it?
We measured it, but it had some other things in the line. I'm trying to subtract them out. But they have other electronics in place, and there's not FPGA electronics. In principle, you could read the signal out faster.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We could talk about that.
Yeah. I'd love to. Also, measuring this is not that trivial. So we hadn't had the time to measure this, actually, for a detector. So there's another problem. I was talking so long about a single photon source, so 2. We were working hard towards this to make 2 photon sources with equal photons, but in this business, only last year, basically, a group has achieved that, and we are working hard on this. So we just distribute single photons to the 2 verifiers. And this we do by using a fast, 1 microsecond, but pretty efficient switch. And so we have a single photon stream. We split it into 2 paths, into 2 fibers. And then we delay one of these fibers. And we make it longer, this fiber, so we delay the photons such that they are then arriving at the same time somewhere. And so this is therefore how it currently looks like in our experiment. 1 single photon source, we demultiplex temporarily the photons to the 2 verifiers. And then we do the polarization modulation, and we then do the experiment. And that it works with 1 microsecond difference. So we demultiplex the photons, and they are still equal. This is something which took the community 2 decades. Because it's the lifetime is around less than a nanosecond, and we're talking now about a microsecond a microsecond delay between photons. And in this microsecond, a lot of bad things can happen in your semiconductor. One electron of the 10 to the 23 that are per cubic centimeter in such a system hopping around will already destroy everything. And but they are so good, the samples, that it doesn't happen. So long story short, we can still see the Hongo-Mandel interference. And I think it's more important that I then show briefly how the experiment really looks like, very briefly. So this is the same sketch what I've shown before. And this is how it looks in the lab. Kirsten's very nicely put everything on a small board. The smaller, the less noise we have in the lab. For QPB, of course, it needs to be spread out in future. These are spools with fibers here. And then very careful characterization makes it now possible that we can draw conclusions about the data, and which is shown here. This is basically the data from last week's. And this shows the coincidences, so of detecting of the four detectors to detect coincidence. Yeah? So as you said before, we want to have for equal photons that A and B or C and D click. A, B would be this here. And CD is this here, this green. And there we see there is more coincidences than in the other parts. And then as a first test, we Kirsten made a model with different amounts of indistinguishability of the photons. This is really the key issue we have in our system. And then, so these are perfectly in these perfect photons. Nah, this doesn't agree. And these are completely useless photons. Luckily, this also doesn't agree. We are somewhere in betweenish here, around 50% indistinguishability probably. And with this, we hope that tomorrow we can work out if these are still allows us to make some QPV claims with our theory colleagues. Very good. With this, let me conclude. I hope I could show you a little bit that single photon sources. It's a complicated thing, but if you have it, it's a nice thing. Experimentalists care about loss a lot and fiber transport, if possible. So working on protocols that use speed of light, classical information is crucial for applications of QPV, also because deployed fibers. I've skipped over one slide. There are fast fibers, nearly speed of light, hollow core fibers, but they are not deployed. They're simply nowhere in the ground, cost a huge amount of money to produce them. They're used at the London Stock Exchange for the crazy high-speed traders. Anyway, we have first data for towards the first QPV demo. Thanks a lot.
Are there other questions? More technical ones. Why your yellow is not the same as your green? Because that's not, they're both equally affected by the indistinguishability or lack thereof of the photons. So.
This is thanks to Kirsten's careful analysis, is because unfortunately our fiber splitters are not 50-50 and all kinds of things.
Ours are more like 55-45 currently.
So next generation will.
If you switch to using polarization and a PBS, then you can tune it. So that's exactly 50-50.
But this is in fiber now.
Yes.
What do you do?
Actually, we found now another company that makes close to 50-50.
Close to 50-50.
Yeah.
They should already be, but. When we could always attenuate it, but this takes already long data taking, so.
And another one is that the detectors A and B have a higher detection efficiency than detectors C and D.
Oh, I see, sure. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you had this picture with the switch in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're showing that you were doing like five photons to the left and five to the right, and then you put them in a delay, or do you want to send a single one to the left and then a single one to the right?
Yeah.
Then I get your delay depending on how many photons you're switching to the left and to the right.
No, the delay just depends on the frequency of switching.
Yeah, but you have a slight on QPV loopholes, and so a horrible loophole which you have currently is that you send even multiple photons per state to get enough data, because our polarization modulators, we use currently squeezer-based ones to have high transmission. There's a company making squeezing fibers to modulate polarization, and they are pretty nice, but kilohertz rate limited, and we need megahertz rate to get significant data. Yes, but now for the switching, it doesn't really matter, I would say. If you modulate the polarization fast enough, that's the key thing. That we each photon pair, or each photon needs to have a unique polarization state. And
but then the speed of the switching doesn't really matter even.
But it matters because we need then to make them at equal time. We need to delay them, and then the fiber loss at a certain point comes into play. But that's zero. Currently, fiber loss is not an issue for our distances. So.
Any other questions? Okay, not the time for the speakers.
Thanks a lot.